Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. If you're a menopausal woman and spend any time on social media, you're familiar with Dr. Corinne Mann. She's a trustworthy voice of science and evidence-based medicine in a sea of influencers who don't always stick to the data. Dr. Mann is also one of the authors of a large study published this month titled Women's Insights on Sexual Health After a Breast Cancer Diagnosis. Today, we're discussing that study. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Mann is a gynecologist who herself was diagnosed with breast cancer in her 20s. She's now one of the most authoritative voices on all things menopause, but has particular expertise in the management of menopause in women with a breast cancer diagnosis. In my last podcast episode with Dr. Mann, the topic was estrogen therapy in women with breast cancer, and if and when it's ever an option. The link is in the program notes, so you can check it out. So welcome, Dr. Mann.
Dr. Stryker, thank you so much. It's always so much fun to talk with you.
It is so much fun. Yeah. You know, I was writing my Come Again episode on sex after breast cancer, and I was checking to see if there were any new articles, and your new study just popped up. So first of all, thank you. You just made my job a whole lot easier. But, you know, it was only after I downloaded it and started to read it that I realized you were one of the authors. So my first question is, you know, we talk all the time and you never mentioned you were working on this. What's with that?
Well, it was all over social media about a year ago. But, you know, it's really interesting because the idea for this study actually happened 2 years ago when I met you for the first time in person at Ishwish. And it's when I became acquainted with Dr. Leila Agarwal, who is one of also the lead authors along with Eleonora Teplinsky. And Leila and I, you know, just connected at Ishwish and I saw, wow, here's a medical breast oncologist who's interested in sexual health after cancer. And she, you know, has a clinic at her institution where she helps women with sex after cancer. So we just started talking because, you know, I'll talk to anybody. And I was like, I have this idea. We need to, like, you know, really bring a shock and awe, frankly, to the medical professional community of how we are really letting women down when it comes to managing not only menopause after cancer, but very specifically sexual health after cancer. And power social media, I became friendly with Eleonora Teplinsky, who has a big social media account, and she provides excellent evidence-based information about, you know, breast cancer care. And the three of us got together and said, let's do this, because we, you know, we're seeing in our own practices what,
you know. But I also thought it was really wonderful that this particular study was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, because it's the oncologists that are seeing these women. It's the oncologists that need to have an increased awareness, not the people in the sexual medicine world. We already know the impact and that it's not being addressed, but the oncologists really needed to have it front and center. So I was so glad that that's where it was studied. So, all right, I have a ton of questions, but I want to start with this. You kind of alluded to a little bit, but more specifically, what was the purpose of doing this study? Why was it important?
Yeah, so now there's certainly literature published that shows that women with breast cancer have sexual dysfunction and that it's not well addressed. And we know that. The past studies, though, didn't really look at where they were getting their information from. Many of the studies in the past didn't really drill down into all of the sexual dysfunction. A lot of the studies might just be about just vaginal dryness, but it didn't answer deeper questions like, how has it impacted your relationship with your partner? Did you have distress over it? And where were you getting your information? That was a big one, right? Especially with the rise of social media. And what type of referrals were you getting, you know? And we tried to dig down into all of the different referrals and the different treatment options that they could be offered. So I think there was more details about the patient-centered experience and really kind of highlighting where they get information.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's no question that this was very different from every other study I've read. And I've have read, you know, a lot of studies. And because this was from the point of view of the patient, and as you said, and we're going to get into the specifics, the questions that you were asked had never been asked before. And these are the things that really, really matter to patients. So how many women ended up participating in this study?
So the study, we had 1,775 respondents.
Wow.
And what's really interesting, I looked this up today, that in the first week, it was a 4 weeks, we had it live for 4 weeks. And we got over 1,000 responses in the first week. Okay. So right there shows the positive. We talk a lot about the negative side of social media, but we distributed this on our social media accounts as well as through the Young Survival Coalition's newsletter, right? Mm-hmm. But I suspect most of the respondents saw it being distributed not only by my account, Eleonora's and Layla's, but then all of our colleagues were sharing it. And then breast cancer advocacy groups, patient-centered groups, then also reshared it. So, wow, for study authors to get over 1,000 responses. Yeah.
That's a huge number. But the only thing I wonder about, and every study always has its limitations, and I would imagine that one of the limitations of this study is that it skewed towards people who were interested in sex. I mean, that's the nature of it. But that's okay, because it's the people who are interested in sex that we want to know if it was addressed appropriately. So it's a limitation, but it's not a limitation.
Yeah. Right? And, you know, and we've learned a lot from this, and that's certainly a limitation of the study. And now that we have this paper published, hopefully other cancer centers will be like, hey, we will help you distribute it in other ways so that we can get even a broader audience, a more racially diverse audience, which was another limitation of the study, which was 90% white. And, you know, the reality is, I think we're probably missing a lot of the women who are still suffering even worse than what was reported here. Because I think the women who are on social media and following our accounts are motivated, are educated, are tend to be like demanding care. So think about the women who don't have that education or even have even heard of, say, vaginal estrogen. My guess is they may be suffering even more.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And what would be interesting to do, which would be, quite frankly, more difficult, more expensive, is to pull all comers to a breast cancer center, as opposed to women, you know, volunteering to do this. So, but in the group that you ended up with, understanding that, you know, definitely was a little bit skewed in certain things, but what was the age range? Because I think that's important, because people think about women who have menopause or sexual problems as being older, but that's certainly not the case in the breast cancer population.
No, so the average age was 47, but the range was as young as 23.
Yeah.
To as high as 75. And, you know, we did work with the Young Survival Coalition, which is dedicated to women who were diagnosed under 40. So we did capture those younger women. Interestingly enough, though, looking back, I think it was about 25 to 30% of the women who participated were thrown into premature menopause. So still had the majority of the patients were women who were, you know, of the age of perimenopause or older.
Yeah. But there were also women in this study that were not menopausal. I mean, just because you have a breast cancer diagnosis doesn't mean that you're in menopause. It depends on if you're younger, what kind of treatment you have. And I think that's important. And I don't know if you separated the women who were menopausal from the women who were not, because that also is going to change the results.
So the majority of the patients, the vast majority of the patients in this study were menopausal, because even if they were premenopausal prior to treatment, treatment threw them into menopause. We had very few women who were still in their periods.
Okay. So I know you looked at things, and we're not going to go through it all now because I want to get to other stuff, but you were very, you know, that you looked at a lot of specifics, such as the stage of their cancer, what kind of treatment they were getting, receptor status, all of that. You looked at that, which was incredibly good data. But what I really want to get to is the results, because those were just fascinating. In the study, when you looked at the impact of cancer treatment on sexual function overall, let's break down, first of all, the symptoms that women were having the hardest time with, because you asked very specifically about symptoms.
Yes. So this was really important to me, because one frustrating thing that I see is that when women are being counseled on the impacts of treatment, particularly ovarian suppression or aromatase inhibitors, they're told you might have vaginal dryness. Right. Yeah. Okay. So we asked about the number one complaint was decreased interest in sex or libido. That was 85% of people reported that. 78% said vaginal dryness, 71% decreased lubrication, almost 70% decreased arousal, 60% painful sex, 40% difficulty with orgasm, and, you know, sex not being pleasurable, 34%. And then other things, body image concerns, fatigue, frequent UTIs, 13%, they were unable to have penetrative sex. 13%, complete loss of orgasm. So, you know.
Yeah. You know, and I said, thank you for asking about orgasm. I mean, nobody ever talks about pleasure. It's all about penetration. And as you and I well know, for a lot of women, penetration is either not part of the pleasure that they have or a small part of it, and that they are looking more towards things like arousal and orgasm. Yeah. And when I was researching Come Again and all of the things about orgasm there, what I found is that the studies in either postmenopause women and certainly women with a cancer diagnosis that anyone actually asks about that are pretty much non-existent. It's like, it's not part of it. And I don't have to point this out to you, but I think it is worth mentioning that when a man is diagnosed with prostate cancer or any other pelvic cancer, that is always part of the discussion from the get-go. You know, you mentioned people are told, well, you might have vaginal dryness and that's the end of it. But men are given a lot more information and also very often will decide what treatment they want based on the side effects, which is not the case for women in breast cancer.
And I think that's so important, Lauren. And I just want to highlight, I recently spoke at a big cancer institute where they asked me to speak about menopause and sexual health. And before I went, another medical oncologist who did a lovely presentation on the very kind of simple basics of treating sexual dysfunction and vaginal dryness. And the focus, there was three slides just on focusing on the use of lidocaine and highlighting how great it was that these studies shows that before and after they were able to quote unquote have sex. But what is able to have sex? You numbed and lubed these patients up, but there was no, and so they said, see, this is so successful. We don't necessarily have to go to vaginal estrogen. I was like, are you kidding me? That has nothing to do.
Well, it was successful for the man. It was successful for the penis, yeah. You know, but that's it wasn't pleasurable for the woman is the point.
But yeah, and that sends the message to oncologists who don't have any training in sexual health or menopause, that that's like lubricants are a solution and they're not.
They're not. They're not. Certainly, you know, and people, when they talk to us about lubricants and when they're okay and when they fail. And as we always tell people, it depends on the degree. If someone has very, very mild dryness, very mild genital urinary syndrome, menopause, then a good silicone lubricant might be adequate. But for someone who it's moderate to severe, and particularly after chemotherapy, it's not going to be enough. But yet that's what women are told, you know, go and try a lubricant.
It's the severe estrogen deprivation that we just need to explain to women of what's actually physiologically happening. And it's not just dryness, it's shrinking of the clitoris in the labia, et cetera, you know, and with a real focus on pleasure.
Real, absolutely. Because when we talk about the impact of lack of estrogen, there are estrogen receptors everywhere. And those estrogen receptors in the clitoris are very much responsible for blood flow and nerve health and sensation. And you can't ignore the poor little clitoris, right? So when we're talking about what people are told, one of the things that you did in this paper, which was really, really, I think the highlight of it is we have this group that is really struggling, really struggling. They're having painful sex. They're not having pleasure. Everything's going wrong. How many of them received information from a healthcare professional?
Less than 30%. So 73% reported that they did not receive any information from their healthcare team.
Yeah. You know, okay. a lot to unpack there. I wasn't sure if I saw this or not. If they did get information, was it because the woman asked for it or was it spontaneously offered?
It was in over 70% of the time reported, they had to initiate the conversation themselves.
Yeah. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Yeah. And when they did get information, how often was it from the oncologist versus that they went back and maybe talked to the gynecologist? You know, were you only asking about the interaction with the oncologist, or were you also saying, did you get this from anybody?
So, our question was, you know, if you received information, which healthcare professional provided it to you? And they could check all that applied. 33% said oncologist, 28% said GYN, 6% said breast surgeon, 12% said a nurse practitioner. And then in single digits were things like radiation oncologist, a physical therapist, 5%, mental health.
How about manicurist? Sometimes the manicurist gives the best information.
Well, other was 36%.
Yes, exactly.
These were health professionals. So, yeah. You know.
All right. Yeah. So we won't give the manicurist that. But yeah. You know what actually kind of surprises me a little bit is I would have expected nurse practitioner and PA to be really up there, because very often that's the person who takes the most time talking to the patient about things like the impact on relationship, lifestyle, all of that.
You know, what I see, this information wasn't that surprising to me in the fact that, and I agree with you that nurse practitioners tend to focus on that, but the way it works for most breast cancer patients, when they're seeing the nurse practitioner or the PA, it tends to be for just the little every 3 month routine check-ins, if they're, you know, not a complicated breast cancer treatment and they're renewing their tamoxifen or their aromatase inhibitor. And what I see a real top-down approach in that if the leadership in the breast center or the, you know, the supervising medical oncologist is not really, you know, interested or making sure that sexual health is part of their patient's care, the nurse practitioners are not necessarily.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, one of the other things also,
you know,
is the timing of this information, because men, of course, are given it right away. And I remember there was a study I saw some years back that asked patients, when would you like to receive this information? Initially at the first appointment, once you're in survivor mode and it's in the rearview mirror, in the middle. And I don't know if you asked that or if you have any thoughts on that.
No, it's a great question. We did not ask that specifically. And something I've heard from both medical oncologists and patients is that when they're first diagnosed, it's too much information and they're overwhelmed and they don't necessarily want it at the very, you know, because in the beginning you're overwhelmed. There's so much to get to. And I don't know what was the survey that you saw. Did you see if there was information about
that? Yeah, it was kind of all over the map. But the consensus really was that most women at a minimum wanted to know that information was available. And with that in mind, when I started the Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause, and I went and I visited all the oncologists, not just breast oncologists, but all the oncologists to say that we were happy to see their patients and we wanted to see their patients and that we didn't expect you to talk about it with your patients. Right. So here's a pamphlet. You know, when you see your patient at the first visit, do you give them a folder of information? Yes, we do. Great. Include this, which basically says, if now or at any time since you have received this diagnosis, you would like to discuss these issues, you know, and we talked, you know, menopause, sexual issues, pleasure, pain, blah, 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 here's where you can find help. And we left about a million pamphlets with them. And then we started asking patients who were coming in, oh, you saw the pamphlet. And pretty much 90% of them said, no, I just heard about this clinic from someone else. And it turned out that they never put the pamphlets in the folders. So there you go. That was just one example, frustrating example. But
and I think, you know, this should be a component of informed consent when people are signing and discussing, you know, what treatment they're about to be on. You know, chemotherapy is one thing. It lasts for 3 to 6 months for the average person. But when you're talking about breast cancer treatments, it's a little different than a lot of cancers out there that particularly for ER positive, you know, these patients are going to be on 5 to 10 years of some sort of hormonal medication, tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, ovarian suppression, or having their ovaries removed. So this isn't like a short time side effect. And, you know, the studies, you know, all over the place here, but anywhere from 15 to honestly, some studies up to 50% of women stop their breast cancer treatments because the collateral damages and side effects are not very well addressed. And one of the top ones is the genitourinary syndrome, menopause and sexual side effects. So I think this is like low hanging fruit that if cancer centers and oncologists could see, if we addressed this, they might be more adherent to their treatment.
Okay, that is huge. And I don't remember seeing that in the paper, but to me, the big banner for oncologists is you will get patients that are more likely to complete their treatment and ultimately have better survivor rates if you treat these symptoms, which are so difficult for them. I mean, right there.
Yeah. And also what I hear from patients and what I experienced personally, because I'll have patients coming thinking that they want the whole kit and the boodle. They're like, Dr. Mann, I want to talk about systemic hormone therapy. I want to talk about all this stuff. And when I just say, okay, wait, hold on. Let's break this down. What are your most prevalent symptoms? Can we give you control back of your life in a few kind of ways? We've got to break it down. And when we can give them some hope, some treatment options for things that are frankly not so hard to treat, we have a lot of solutions for sexual cancer.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to get to that because...
And that's empowering. And then they're like, oh, well, if you help me with this, it alleviates a huge, you know, weight off my shoulders. And we can get into some of the results, like how it affects their relationships, their partners, and the distress. That's really what it comes down to. Women are willing to deal with a lot of treatment side effects. But when like almost 85% said they had a moderate to a great deal of distress in their lives because of this, that's huge.
It's enormous. Yeah. So, okay. On one hand, these numbers of people that got information, shockingly low, but let's be honest, even women without a breast cancer diagnosis go to see their doctors postmenopause and perimenopause. And how many of those women are getting information? The numbers are the same, right? Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, okay. So do we have unrealistic expectations? Do breast cancer patients, should they be getting more? How are they different from other patients? You know what I mean? Are we putting too much on the oncologist to expect them to do this? We all agree that it should happen. But realistically, if we can't even get gynecologists to talk about it, how are we going to get the oncologist to talk about it?
Well, I think we don't, the oncologist's job does not have to be to solve all of these problems, but they do have really a medical and ethical responsibility to have a referral network and have a few, they don't have to do it all, but they need to understand this is part of treating the cancer, because not only does it affect treatment adherence, but while you're right that the average menopausal woman doesn't get the information and does have some of these symptoms, the reality is that the symptoms and the impact on their lives are so much more severe because this is abrupt. This is prolonged estrogen deprivation. This is severe estrogen deprivation. As not just estrogen deprivation, there's other, you know, problems.
Right, right.
So it's more severe, it's more prolonged, and it's
and very often it's in younger women too.
And in younger women, particularly with all of the talk that we're diagnosing cancers in general at a younger age. So, you know, and women are living longer with it. So they might be living a long time with these symptoms.
Well, a long time. And to your point, women with a breast cancer diagnosis, even if it's way in their rearview mirror, are very often told you can't use a local vaginal estrogen and just be glad you're alive. And you shouldn't need to, you know, wonder about this. And no, you know, you're not going to get that information. So to answer my own question, this is a different group. They do deserve more information because the repercussions are so much greater. All right. So it's one thing to have someone who says, sure, let's talk about it. And then it's another thing to see what kind of information these women were actually given. And that was another really incredible part of this study, because I don't think I've ever seen so much detail in terms of the information that people were given and the bigger group that were, quite frankly, given misinformation. So let's just start with that. And I don't know if you have this number exactly, but of the women who did receive information, do we know what percent received any kind of accurate information? I mean, we're going to talk about the misinformation because there was a lot of that. But how did they get good information? Do we know?
So, you know, we didn't get into whether it was accurate or not. I think we just got information about what they were given. Like, so were they given a referral or information about, you know, options? And we do have those specific numbers, and it's pretty stark. So basically, in terms of what were you offered as treatments, and we wanted to do more than vaginal estrogen because we know there's a lot more than vaginal estrogen.
Right.
Of the people who answered, 65% had no treatment option offered. 15%.
Wait, you said 65%?
No, nothing was offered. If they had a sexual health concern, they didn't get anything offered. So 15% got referred to a pelvic floor physical therapist. 4% got the bane of my existence, lidocaine gel. 10% vaginal dilators. 2% vibrators. 6% vaginal laser therapy. And then less than half even had a discussion about vaginal estrogen. And then if they had a discussion about it, less than 30% were, you know, walked away with a prescription for it.
And then we don't even know. And walking away with a prescription is not the same as filling the prescription, using the prescription, and continuing to use the prescription.
And then in the where we did drill down into accuracy is we asked, there was a specific question, what were you told about vaginal hormones after breast cancer? So 22% said they were told it's not an option for you because you have breast cancer in general. 46% said, well, it was not an option for us, for me, because I had ER positive breast cancer. 20% said, yes, it was an option for me, but less than, you know, like I said, about 28% actually walked away with a prescription. Who knows if they used it properly.
Did you ask how many of them used the prescription? Because that's a different question.
No. And so that would be like a whole nother. We have lots of.
Well, no, because a lot of people, they get the prescription, they go home and they read the black box warning, which we've talked about a lot, about how none of that is true. And we can get, you know, drill down on that a little bit more. But they get home and they read that and they think, okay, it's not worth having a decent orgasm if I'm going to get dementia, blood clot, and recurrence of my cancer. So we know that these prescriptions very often don't get filled, or they go to another healthcare clinician who says, no. All right. But the thing that also was just striking is you had an opportunity for people to write in comments. And, you know, most of it was a multiple choice thing that they had to just click off the box, but you also gave an opportunity for people to say, okay, so what were you told? And you mentioned a number of them. The one that really jumped out at me was the woman who commented that she was offered 3 porn sites on a post-it note and then told to force herself to have more sex. I mean, from a medical professional who told her that. Yeah. I mean,
and the thing is, I mean, I wish that was like an isolated comment, but it's not. There was a lot of themes of use it or lose it. We have literally thousands of comments because in many of the questions we had an area where they can, you know, just write comments. And at the very end, we also allowed, is there anything else you want us to say? So, you know, we do have a table with some of the selected comments. I don't know if you want me to like read out.
Yeah, I'd love to hear some of these comments.
So my sex drive is gone and I'm in pain with even touching anywhere in my vagina. It has destroyed my ability to enjoy intercourse. I've lost all sex drive. I feel like the bride of Frankenstein after the mastectomy tram flap, broken skin from radiation, chemo-induced menopause. I find myself undesirable. Sex is simply too painful and I've lost all sensation in libido. The impact on relationships, Lauren, is another thing that I'll read some comments on and just want to highlight. You know, over 70% of women said that it impacted their relationship with their partner. My husband is very patient. He doesn't fault me, but I feel bad about my complete lack of interest. I don't feel like a woman. Anticipating sex is no longer exciting. It's filled with worry and dread. Our intimate time is short. The pain becomes too much to bear. It's impacted intimacy and physical connection. It's taken a toll on both of us. Extreme anxiety. I avoid dating. The information about sexual health. It's shocking and unfair how little information I received. After complaining, I was given a pamphlet about vaginal dryness that was useless. Not one physician brought anything up. I have 4 different doctors following me. You know, the treatments offered was the porn site on a post-it note. One said I referred to an OBGYN, waited months, and then that person's specialty was actually infertility. And then the different responses, as you alluded to. One doctor says yes, oncologist says no. Oncologist says it's an option, but the GYN says that's probably not the best tool. Or take at the risk scenario, or if nothing else works and your quality of life is miserable, we can talk about it. And, you know, we're trying to find a way to, and we're coming up with ways, but I have like a stack here. I can show you, I'm flipping through it, of just like literally a few thousand comments that, you know, just continue to repeat.
Yeah. I mean, this is a book. But the other thing that I think it's important to point out is while this study specifically was looking at a breast cancer diagnosis, this is not a whole lot different than we see from women who have other cancer diagnoses, particularly pelvic cancer diagnoses, whether we're talking colon cancer, rectal cancer, the gynecologic cancers, vulvar cancer. So while breast cancer has some things that are very specific in terms of the fear of hormones, the impact of treatment on sexual function is very widespread. We're going to talk about treatment because now that we've put this out there, we don't want to leave people hanging. Yeah. And this is a little bit of a preview to my Come Again episode on treatment for sexual problems after cancer diagnosis. And the difference is I'm going to be talking about all kinds of cancers, not just breast cancer. Today, we're really going to focus more on breast cancer. But I want to start with the safety of local vaginal estrogen, because that's the thing that they're is still the most questions about, in spite of you and me and many, many other experts being out there. And we think everybody knows this because we're out there talking about it all the time, but not everybody's on social media. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is listening to you. So can you just once again state the issues, if any, of a woman with a breast cancer diagnosis using one of the local vaginal estrogen products, whether it's a cream, a ring, a tablet, a suppository, or an insert?
FDA-approved vaginal hormones. Primarily, we talk about estradiol, but yes, there's a product, DHEA, brand name Intrarosa. These options are safe for all breast cancer survivors, whether you're in the middle of chemotherapy or treatment with something like tamoxifen, ovarian suppression, aromatase inhibitors. And we do have a range of even lower dose options within it, but these are local, meaning they're not systemically absorbed. The biggest question I get, Lauren, is, okay, but what about aromatase inhibitor and ovarian suppression? And while we don't have as large of studies looking very specifically at that population, we do have data on it, and it is safe. And in those cases, if we want to be extremely careful, because the context is that the aromatase inhibitors are keeping systemic estrogen levels even lower than a normal menopausal woman, we have excellent very low dose preparations, like the lowest dose of the estradiol tabs, inserts, the estrogen estradiol ring. We've got the DHEA options. So these are all on the table. And unfortunately, because of the label, as well as because of lack of education, women get conflicting information. But I want to remind listeners, American College of OBGYN, the Menopause Society, American Society for Clinical Oncology, NCCN guidelines all state that these products can be used. So American Urologic Association, they're new GSM. So if you're getting barriers, you need to be a squeaky wheel and say there are professional recommendations. This is actually not controversial.
Absolutely. And I gave a lecture last year. I gave grand rounds to the breast oncologists at Harvard University. And this was not controversial. When I presented the data in the same slides that you always use, looking at how much is actually absorbed, what is the impact, looking at data that looks at recurrence of cancer, which is not increased. This is not cumulative. It doesn't matter if you've been using vaginal estrogen for 1 year or 50 years. The levels are not any higher in your body. And we have that kind of data, which is reassuring. The other thing also that I think is not talked about enough is there are a lot of different ways, you kind of alluded to using a local vaginal estrogen. And some people, I mean, a lot of people are just given the same instructions. Everyone's told, you know, put it here, put it there. And the truth is that when you're examined, and you should be examined, there should be a very, very careful evaluation of where is the pain? Where is the dryness? Is it in the vestibule, the opening of the vagina? Is it inside? It may be that your only issue is at the opening, and a little bit of cream dabbed on that area a few times a week is really going to be sufficient. If you're having problems with orgasm, a little dab of estrogen cream on the clitoris is going to help with blood flow. And you know what we know is that even for people that are using standard doses, that the amount of estrogen that gets absorbed in a full year of local vaginal estrogen is what, like one birth control pill a year, something like that, even less?
And I love that you comment on the different ways to give it. And this is where, this is the art of practicing medicine. You need to understand, like, I see a lot of patients, be given, be prescribed the estradiol or Vagifem is the brand name tablet twice a week. So they pop a little dry tablet twice a week. And we wonder why they still have pain at the entrance of the vagina or that they still have diminished orgasm. Other people more have urinary symptoms and they're only dabbing estrogen on the outside and they're not getting it up inside. So it gets into the bladder. So we have to do a more detailed history and it doesn't take very long, frankly.
No. And the other thing also is, it used to be that years ago, I would tell people telehealth is out of the question. You need to be examined. You need to be examined. You need to be examined. And I have changed my tune on that because in a perfect world, every woman would be examined to see specifically where her issues are. But let's be honest here. Most women do not have access to someone who can help them. And I know you do telehealth. I've been involved with some telehealth companies. And I think realistically, I think the word needs to be, that's a reasonable place to start. And if your symptoms are clear cut and you get a prescription for local vaginal estrogen or DHEA and it's working, yay, you're done. If you're not, you need to be examined.
Yeah,
and would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. And also, like, you have to ask patients, you know, what is the problem? You know, is it urinary? Is it orgasm? Where's the pain? And you can go through those questions pretty quickly and then tailor your instructions on the use of the estrogen. And really important for anybody listening, you know, I feel like that applicator that comes with the vaginal cream is a freaking barrier to women getting adequate treatment.
Have you seen my YouTube video on what to do with the applicator? It involves throwing it over my shoulder.
You love the applicator. God bless you.
Get rid of it. Yeah, use your finger. Use your finger. Yeah.
Because when it leaks out and it's in your underwear and then that's irritating and it's not working, they give up and they say it didn't.
Well, not to mention, what are you going to do? Put it in the dishwasher and then your son unloads it and says, what's this? I mean, who needs the friggin' applicator? Get rid of it. But you know what? There's another problem with the applicator that I want to mention that I've talked about a number of times in my episodes. But people who use these applicators, what's the most similar thing to that? It's a tampon applicator. What did you do with the tampon applicator? You put it in as far as possible to get it as high in the vagina as possible. That's not the goal here. Yeah. The estrogen receptors, the androgen receptors in the vagina are primarily in the lower third. Yes. We want to get it, as we mentioned, on the vestibule. So when you put that cream in the vagina, you're not treating your cervix. Don't go for gold. You know, put it in just a few inches and you'll get a lot more bang for your buck and, quite frankly, less absorption if that's, you know, what you're looking for. So I just thought I'd throw that out there because it's not mentioned very often and I think it's important. All right, this is the question I want to ask you because this happens a lot, is that someone who has an oncologist that they trust, they like, this person is helping them through this whole breast cancer thing. And the gynecologist who they also like and are seeing says, you know what, I'm going to give you vaginal estrogen. It's perfectly fine to take with your diagnosis. Check with your oncologist. They go to their oncologist and their oncologist says, no. What's that woman supposed to do in a practical, real world? Because she doesn't want to go against her oncologist and argue. She doesn't want to use it secretly, but yet she's not going to change on college. And what does she do? What do you tell these women?
Oh, yeah, this is an excellent question. And this is where, unfortunately, we have to just admit that the real world experience is not perfect and it's not going to get there for a while. So if this is a part of your life that you want to improve and you are struggling with GSM, sexual health, low desire symptoms, and you want to use a local vaginal hormone, you're the CEO of your health. You have to understand that you are not asking for permission from your oncologist. You are asking for partnership and shared decision-making. And if that is their opinion and the GYN or other, you know, doctor prescribed that for you, you know, you really have to advocate for yourself. And I try to give women some tools in that. And I think, you know, if you go to like my link in bio, I have a Google document that anybody can download and it has all of the studies in there. So you could go and print out, you know, a few papers and you can say, I'd like shared decision-making on this. And if you can give me some reasons why I should not do this, I will listen to them. But in the end, it's your body. It's your choice. You know, right. It really is like reproductive choice extends really beyond just our ability for reproduction. It includes our choice of how we deal with our bodies, even in menopause. Yes, even with cancer. And also sometimes remind women, you must share, even if you feel embarrassed, with your medical oncologist, the true impact, and that it's more than dryness. So don't be embarrassed. Write it up in a bullet point. Say, but doctor, you don't understand. It's not just it's dry, because yes, the lubricant helps there, but I can't orgasm. My relationship is breaking down. I haven't had sex in 6 months or a year. I'm afraid to date. When we do have sex, I get micro tears. I wake up every night to pee multiple times. I have multiple urinary tract infections. So doctor, it's not just a little vaginal dryness and my moisturizer and my lubricant. That's nice. It's not preventing the atrophy of my clitoris or my risk of urinary tract infections, et cetera. And sometimes they're just like, oh, okay, you're right. The GYN wrote this. Cool. I'm done. They're okay with it then.
I also think the other thing that people sometimes don't do, and you hate to put the burden on the GYN to say, could you please call my oncologist? You know, you don't have to be the middleman. And because it's easier for the GYN to say, hey, I keep up to date with this literature. You might not, because you're so busy curing cancer. So let me send you some articles. And I think that goes over sometimes a lot better than it shouldn't. And it should be, you know, that shared decision making. Yeah. But when you have a patient who gives their doctor articles, sometimes they're like, yeah, right. I don't want to read your articles. As opposed to coming from another physician. So I'm just throwing that out there as
totally. I totally agree. And, but in the end, you know, this is the burden of being a cancer survivor that, you know, unfortunately, you really do have to take charge, get yourself really informed. And sometimes you have to make a separate appointment. Maybe the nurse practitioner or the medical oncologist who's doing your routine visit for your other cancer stuff doesn't have time because of the horrible medical system we have where they're rushed appointments. It's not the doctor's fault. And say, hey, I appreciate your care. I want to work with you. Be positive. Can we have a follow-up appointment where we dive into this? Here's this guideline from the AUA or NAMS or whatever. Let's talk, right?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. All right. I want to get to one last thing in the time we have left, because you did something else in this paper, which has never, never been done before. And that was talk about the impact of social media. You know, how, because now we live in a world where people get their information, not just from their doctors, not from healthcare professionals, but from social media. So in this very large group, how many of them turn to social media for information?
So when we look back at their source of information, so when we ask, have you received information about sexual health after cancer from any social media platform? 73% got no information from their healthcare team. 80% said they got it from social media. And then when we break down where on social media were they getting the information, 66% from Instagram, 25% from Facebook, and then, you know, single digits for TikTok, YouTube. Now, obviously, we were advertising this on social media.
That's right. Huge group.
We know that. But what was interesting is when we asked what was the best source, you know, they still said that in the end, the best source that they got, even if they were getting it from the healthcare, you know, provider or from the hospital, you know, cancer center, they still said by far the best information was coming from social media. And then we drilled down where on social media, like which accounts.
Right. Were these breast cancer survivors? Were these healthcare professionals? You know, what kind of accounts were they looking at?
Yeah. So we asked them, so like, if you received information on social media, what was the source of that information? And so the categories were healthcare professionals with accounts, patient accounts, professional medical societies, et cetera. 70% said they received the information from a doctor or another healthcare professional. About 18% said they found the information from a patient account. 40% got information from patient like advocacy support groups. Only 4% from professional medical societies, 3% from a hospital account or cancer center account. Now, to be fair, most cancer centers don't have their own social media accounts. Most professional medical societies, if they have an account, it's not that robust.
And that's correct. I mean, in my center at Northwestern, even though I wanted to have a social media account, we did not.
Yeah. And I think that will change over time. I don't blame those centers. They're doing lots of other things. And there's lots of concerns they have about doing it right and doing it, you know, in a responsible way. But, you know, the ship has sailed. The message is the ship has sailed. Patients are not looking to pamphlets. And the fact is that the healthcare system doesn't allow doctors time that they deserve or compensation for this. So it would behoove a cancer center to have some sort of reliable information that they do get out on social media, because the world has changed and we have to change with it. And there's a real opportunity there for them to get good information to their patients, and because it's easy, it's accessible, and it doesn't take any time.
Do you have any idea how much information that was gotten from social media was good information versus misinformation or even disinformation? And just so people know, the difference between misinformation and disinformation is just stuff that's not based in science, that's wrong, but you know, people mean well, as opposed to disinformation, which is intentionally giving information which is known to be incorrect.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good follow-up study, but we didn't get into, you know, what they were told and I think, you know,
I can guess. Yeah. I think most of these people got their information from you. it was terrific information.
I mean, and maybe so. And so it makes me, you know, feel, you know, pretty strongly that, you know, most women out there who are not following me or my colleagues or people like you, and you know, they're getting even less and they're suffering, you know, even more.
Yeah. Did you keep track? Did you ask people specifically what site they got the information or which person they got the information? Like, do you know how many of these were from you?
We didn't.
Yeah. Would have been kind of interesting. So this paper came out, what was it, like a week ago or something, 2 weeks ago? Has there been impact? Has there been media interest? Has there been people talking to you about it?
So, you know, and so this got released, but the print version hasn't gone out yet, right? So this was like kind of ahead of print. So next month it will go out in the actual Journal of Clinical Oncology. And hopefully that, and we're starting to do things like, we're so grateful that you have me on to talk about it. And we are going to try to kind of pitch this and get other media interested in it, because what I feel like it really is this kind of shock and awe. The results are sad and startling. Hopefully it just jars both patients to say like, hey, this is not okay. And advocacy groups, patient support groups to be like, okay, we maybe need to bring this up to our members and to kind of wake up the medical professionals out there that, listen, we know your job is really hard, but we have some, you know, tips in our paper of how they can kind of just get started in offering this. And we are going to do follow-up. We're really, really excited. Our next one, we have two planned in the WISH series, Women's Insights into Their Sexual Health. The next one we're going to do is in BRCA pre-vivors who are either, you know, having prophylactic surgeries, either, you know, mastectomies or...
Yeah, women who have a genetic mutation, which puts them at very high risk for breast ovarian cancer.
And, you know, what is their experience in getting sexual health information? And then the next one is the GYN cancer patients. So WISH GYN. So
I would also love to see women with GI cancers, rectal and colon. Those numbers are going up, and these are pelvic cancers. And it's such important work. And I think also what we really haven't emphasized, but I think is important, is that the expectation is not that oncologists are suddenly going to become sexual medicine experts. All they need to do is inquire about it and let women know that there are experts who can help them. And if they're not equipped to do so, then have solid referrals in place so that women can get that information, you know, because I think a lot of people are sitting there and saying, okay, you know, really, you really expect the breast cancer doctors to do all this? And the answer is no, we expect them to ask about it and then refer.
Yeah. And we expect them to actually be up to date on their own medical society's guidelines. They can't be giving misinformation. That's the problem. Not only are they not asking about it, but when they are asked about it, they tell patients wrong information.
Well, particularly that they can't use a local vaginal estrogen product when in fact that is simply not true. And that's not controversial. Just to be clear, this is not controversial. The science is solid. We know that, you know, there's this movement that's been going on for many, many years to get that label taken off of local vaginal estrogens. This will likely happen because there is good science to support that.
Yeah. And I think that I know it's expensive and hard and not easy to have sexual medicine clinics at these cancer centers, but I really think, considering it doesn't seem like cancer is going away from our society, and you'll be the most popular cancer center if you are actually addressing these things, because word gets around. And, you know, when people are trying to decide, when people come to me and say, like, where should I go for my cancer care? I'm in the New York tri-state area. I can tell you that there are some famous places that sometimes I say, you know what, if you really want good survivorship issues, I might send you to this other excellent place, because they actually care about it. Because you are in this for the marathon, not the sprint. And where you start is not where you have to stay.
And that's an important point, because people have this idea that where they have their initial biopsy, that they are somehow wed to that place. And I can't tell you how many patients would say to me, I have an abnormality on my mammogram and I need to get a biopsy. And I give them six places and say, just whoever can do it first of these excellent places. And they're like, well, I don't know if I want to get my care there. And I'm like, don't worry about that. Get your diagnosis first and you can switch. And by the same token, you can start initial care someplace and say, this isn't working out for me. As you said to yourself, be the CEO of your own health.
Yeah.
This is shared decision-making, and you don't have to get permission for anything. It's really a conversation between you and the healthcare professionals. So,
totally. And Lauren, I also just want to add that, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about painful sex, vaginal estrogen, but like we asked a lot also about low desire, low libido. So, you know, like 80% said that they had some form of low desire and libido. And what's really unfortunate is, you know, you are an expert in this. You talk about all the time is that we do have a lot of options. So anybody listening to this, understand it's a lot more than just vaginal estrogen. We have medications. We have lots of other ways to treat low desire. But if it hurts, your brain is never going to desire it.
Oh, right. And that's one of the things that we talk about all the time, is that if someone has low desire, very often it is because sex is painful and your brain's not stupid and it's going to say, I don't want to go there if it's painful. But even once the pain is eliminated,
yeah,
a lot of women have low desire for many reasons, including many women are on antidepressants, which might have killed their desire or killed their ability to have an orgasm, because it's not unusual and is very often appropriate to give a woman with a cancer diagnosis an antidepressant to help her get through a lot of this stuff.
Or even for her hot flashes, yeah.
Absolutely. But then very often they get the sexual side effects, which, of course, I have an episode on that as well. But the point is that there's a lot going on and we're solution-driven and there are solutions. And I think if nothing else, that's the message that people should get from this, is if you haven't been given a solution, it doesn't mean there's not a solution. You just may need to see someone who has the expertise to give you those options, which is why I am so glad that you took the time to come on and talk about this stuff, because no one is more solution-driven than you, which is one of the many reasons I love being with you and talking to you. So thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to put all kinds of information in the program notes about where to find you, a lot of the things that we talked about in terms of references, referrals, how to find a sexual medicine expert if you do have not just a breast cancer diagnosis, but a cancer diagnosis. And what would you like to finish with?
Well, if you're a medical professional out there and you're listening to this podcast and you want to help us distribute the next survey, get in touch with me, because we really want to expand it beyond our social media accounts and, you know, work with. So that's number one. And if you're a cancer survivor of any sort and you have really struggled with sexual health, I promise you, both Dr. Stryker and I have seen miraculous recovery and changes and improvements when given the right tools. Hope is not lost. I've seen people who have had really, really terrible sexual dysfunction, really painful sex, all sorts of things, and we can improve things faster than you think.
And just to add on to your end, I have to say that as a sexual medicine expert, there are a lot of things that are not so easy to treat. And when people would come to the clinic and this was their problem, we'd get all happy because we'd say, this is something we can treat. We have so many tools in our toolbox, and not to overpromise, but this is one of those situations that more times than not, we're able to reverse what's going on, even if it's been a long time. And I think that's a very important message. You know, this isn't something that needs to be addressed immediately. If you are 5 years, 10 years, 15 years out from a breast cancer diagnosis, that's okay. You can still get help. you can still get help. It's not like there's this little window of opportunity and you've lost your chance. So I thought I would just throw that in.
Love it. I agree.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.